Okay, hi, thanks for coming, everybody. So in the past few months, I've been working on plenty of little things instead of one big thing. So I thought about putting these little things together, like in an apéro, instead of one big main dish. So my first is going to be about the dynamics of quantum uncertainty in quantum mechanics. My second, I'm going to tell you about gravitizing quantum mechanics and the effects of gravity on quantum mechanics. And then my third is going to be about the usual procedure in quantum gravity of quantizing some gravitational models. So here, the black hole mini superspace. And so my whole is going to be about the interface of quantum and gravity. That was not an equivalence. Interface. Yeah, okay. So why am I talking about interface of quantum and gravity instead of quantum gravity? So usually when you talk about quantum gravity, you have this intuition that you're going to try to quantize gravity, so that it's going to be about quantizing gravity. But although it's true that the initial mission of quantum gravity is to tame the quantum fluctuations of the space-time geometry, it seems that the question of quantum gravity has grown much beyond that. So it seems it's much more. It has many facets. So now we're not only about quantizing gravity, it's also about gravitizing the quantum and about understanding some deeper truth or insights on the fundamental structures of space-time and of physics. So quantum gravity has provided plenty of insights. Of course, the relativity of space-time, but different observers see different space-times. But gravity is not actually just a force, it's some emergent phenomena. That there's a non-trivial thermodynamics of a space-time geometry, that there's holography, which is some expression of non-locality and locality at the same time, but I'm not going to dwell on that. So quantum gravity is about all these things. So of course you could try to really focus on quantizing gravity, for instance, or gravitizing the quantum. But if you really want to quantize gravity, then you must remember that the process of quantization is just, if I push it to the extreme, is some mathematical trick to start with some classical theory and guess the quantum theory, which is supposed to be more fundamental. And well, we really try really hard to do that. Although I remember when I was doing my master's, the professor kept telling me that one should not quantize an effective theory, but it is exactly what we're trying to do. And then on the other side, there's gravitizing the quantum. But if gravity is supposed to be an emergent dynamics of some more fundamental degrees of freedom, does it really make sense to modify quantum mechanics according to gravity? So I decided to go back, erase all of what I've been doing over the past few years, and try to come back to something more basics. And that's what I'd like to tell you about. But instead of seeing quantum gravity as some unification of quantum gravity, I really believe it should be about some deepening of both concepts. It is true that it's something that my PhD supervisors have been telling me 20 years ago, Lee and Carlo. It took a little time to sink in. I'm going to tell you about these three little stories and the morals and the lessons that we can draw from them for quantum gravity. So first, I'd like to tell you about quantum uncertainty, so that wave packets, wave functions are spread. So I have noticed that there's often some kind of bad connotation about quantum uncertainty, but it's something that's uncertain, something that you should try to hide, to get rid of. But in fact, in quantum mechanics, it is one of the main actors of quantum mechanics. So it is a legitimate degree of freedom that really reflects the quantum fluctuations. And it is legitimate because it has a dynamics on its own. So things can have quantum fluctuations independently of the main classical trajectory. And it is something that is totally experimentally relevant. So it's about squeezing modes. It's about talking about the quantum to classical transitions and the wave function collapse. And really, it's the main object. Because if you just take quantum uncertainty and you push it to the extreme, actually, it's just about quantum superpositions. So it's really the main thing. in quantum mechanics. So if I try now to make things a bit more precise and not just words. So in classical mechanics, you're studying the evolution, the trajectory for a point particle, so x of t. And in quantum mechanics, you're going to raise x instead of being the thing that you really measure. It's going to become a variable of your wave function. So you're going to look at a wave function or a field psi of x and t. So from this perspective, you see the dynamics of a wave function as the dynamics of a classical field. So this wave function is going to carry an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So x of t is just about 1 degree of freedom. Well, if you're in 3D, 3 degrees of freedom. Just let's say it's 1D, so it has 1 degree of freedom, whereas on the opposite, psi of x and t is going to carry an infinity of these degrees of freedom. So usually you either look at it as psi of x, or usually go to Fourier modes to look at particle excitations of with given momentum, so the component psi of p, or you can look at it from a more somatoclassical point of view and look at the multiple moments of your wave function. So the average of x, the average of p as operators, which are usually called, referred to as the classical degrees of freedom. And then you have the quadratic uncertainties, and altogether the approximate Gaussian wave packets. And then you can go to higher multiple moments and look at all the non-Gaussianities of your wave function. So here what I'd like to tell you about is the evolution of all these multiple moments, and not only of the classical degrees of freedom. So from that point of view, it's a bit like quantum mechanics is about dressing the classical trajectory with extra quantum dressing. So here I'd like to tell you about one possible application of seeing the quantum uncertainty as a physical observable. So what could I do with it? So here, what I'd like to propose is to use it as an internal clock for your systems. The logic is very simple. If something evolves, then I can use it as a clock. So if a quantum uncertainty evolves, I can use it as a clock. Then, since I've been raised in quantum gravity, can I use this quantum uncertainty as a notion of time intrinsic to each system to solve or to apply to the problem of time in quantum gravity? So usually the problem of time in quantum gravity, it's about the problem of constructing physical observables. And so since you don't have an external clock to refer to, you need to introduce some kind of internal clock and build relational observables, so expressing the correlations between one system and another one, and use one of these two systems as clock for the other one. So here it would be more about using the internal degrees of freedom of your system as an internal clock. So the logic is pretty simple. It would be to look at relational observables between a system's main degrees of freedom and its multiple moments of its own wave function, so its quantum fluctuation. So it would be something like that. So that's where I would like to go, but it's not what I'm going to tell you today. I'm going to do something much, much more simple, which is to illustrate this idea of using the quantum uncertainty as a clock in a much simpler system. And I'm going to come back to the simplest model that you have in physics, meaning 1D classical mechanics. I'm sorry to take you back to school, but I'm going to look at a classical oscillator, but with a time-dependent frequency there. So the equation of motion is just second derivative of q equal to omega squared q. But here, omega depends of t. Okay. So since you have an explicit time dependence in your potential, then it opens the door of choosing different clocks, different time variable to describe the evolution of your system. It's not that the system is going to be inverted at time of parameterization. It's just that to solve the equation of motion, you have the freedom of choosing an appropriate time. So let's play the reparametrization game. So what happens to this system if I change time variable? So instead of looking at the time t, I will look at another time t tilde, which is f of t. Then you can see that this system is actually almost invariant under this kind of transformation. So it is not time parameterization invariant, but almost, in a very simple way. So you adjust, you put some conformal factor in front of the transformation for q, for the position, which is the square root of the Jacobian of the time parameterization function. And then you see that the action is going to be invariant if you adjust your time-dependent frequency. So the time-dependent frequency is going to change by some Jacobian factor, which is the normal thing, plus a Schwarzschild derivative of your time optimization function. So if you do that, since you have the equality of the actions, the initial and final action, so it means it's a symmetry. It's a symmetry in an extended sense that you map all the classical solution of this system for omega onto the classical solution of this system for omega tilde. A symmetry would be if omega tilde was the same as omega. But so in that case, well, afterwards. So here, yeah, you have a symmetry, so a mapping between two systems. And for those who recognize, this is just the Virasoro group action on Sturm-Liouville operators. So it's something very well studied in mathematics and physics. So there's a special case, as I was saying, where omega is equal to omega tilde. It's a symmetry, which is the conformal symmetry for classical mechanics under SL2R, Mobius transformation of the time. So if you have a transformation where t is n to alpha t plus beta divided by gamma t plus delta, a Mobius transformation, then its Schwarzschild vanishes, and you have that omega is equal to omega tilde. So it's some conformal transformation, conformal symmetry of all classical mechanics. But here I'm going to use exactly the fact that omega is not the same as omega tilde. So how am I going to use that? I'm going to use that to map the time-dependent frequency onto a constant frequency. So basically making the system much simpler. So you have something that oscillates but weirdly in time. And I just want to come back to my beloved harmonic oscillator. OK? So can I do that? Can I have something that beeps regularly? So I just do a change of time, where here, so eta, to write it in a convenient way, h was the Jacobian, so the time derivative of my parameterization function. It was f dot. And I just look at eta, which is h, the inverse square root. And then it means that if eta satisfies this auxiliary differential equation, then I would have mapped omega onto a constant big omega. Okay, so this is the equation which defines a kind of good clock, what I call a synchronizing clock, something that makes your system beats regularly. The only problem with this differential equation is that it is nonlinear, so it's not obvious how to solve it. But upon doing that, upon finding a solution of that, then you have a harmonic oscillator, a standard harmonic oscillator, and you can solve it. So all that was to define the notion of synchronizing clock for which the oscillator beats regularly. So once you have eta satisfying that, then you can come back to your change of time, which is going to be the integral of the inverse squared of eta. And once you have that, then you can solve all your system. So usually the system, solving a system in classical mechanics is about finding constant of motions. So here there's a nice constant of motion that is called the Ermakov-Lewis invariant. So it is this, it is defined in terms of that synchronizing clock, eta function, and the position. And it is this thing where you have some kind of angular momentum term and you have some nonlinear term there. But what's important is that this is a constant motion on classical solutions. So in fact, these things you can see, you can apply Noether theorem, and you will see after some straightforward calculations that it is actually the noted charges for the Möbius transformation, the Möbius symmetry and the SL2R that I told you about earlier. But it's not very enlightening. So really the question here is where, how can I determine a synchronizing clock? How can I find one? And what does this concept of motion mean? And what I'm going to show you is that solving that, this classical problem, is going to come from quantum mechanics. So now I'm going to move to quantum mechanics. I'm going to quantize my system. So I'm going to have my Schrödinger equation with my time-dependent harmonic potential there. And I'm just going to look at the simplest thing I can do. It's look at the dynamics of a Gaussian wave packet. So it's the first approximation for any semi-classical probability amplitude. So if I take a Gaussian wave packet, which is like that, so with a phase term, the momentum, phase, and a Gaussian spread there, where p is the momentum, a is the complex width, which I write in this way, which looks complicated, but alpha and beta, this parameterization is chosen so that you have a clear physical meaning. So you compute the different expectation values of the momentum and the position, and you have obviously that this parameter q is the expected position, p is the expected momentum, alpha is the spread in position, and beta is some kind of spread in the momentum. And you're going to insert this and that onto the Schrödinger equation and check when is such a Gaussian wave packet solution to your quantum mechanical problem. So it's going to be very simple. Your Schrödinger equation is going to induce some effective equation of motion on the position and uncertainties. So you're going to have equation differential equation on q, p, alpha, and beta, which are very simple. So here you recognize the classical equation of motion. Great. So your expected position and momentum are classical variables. And then you're going to get some equations for alpha and beta. So this is the dynamics of uncertainty. And you notice that it's almost the same, except you have a kind of ugly term there. This ugly term is beautiful, because it is exactly the term that you need to say that alpha is a solution to your auxiliary differential equation, which I come back here, determining a synchronizing clock. So it means that you can use your position uncertainty as a clock for which in which your system is going to beat regularly with this frequency. And so, as I said, your spread or your wave function and the way it oscillates is going to be to determine a nice time for your system. So now what about the Ermakov-Lewis invariant? So can I see a quantum origin for it in the same way that I determine a synchronizing clock using the quantum uncertainty? So you compute it. You plug into the beautiful formula that I gave earlier, and you see that it's exactly the Schrödinger uncertainty. So the product of the spread in position times the spread in momentum minus their expectation values. So really, the invariant for classical mechanics, so the noted charge for your conformal symmetry of classical mechanics is the quantum uncertainty of your wave packet. So that was a very simple example of a classical mechanical problem that needs to find a solution in quantum mechanics. But beyond that, the point that I wanted to underline is that quantum uncertainty has a non-trivial evolution that you can use it to define an internal clock, an intrinsic clock to your system, which has interesting properties. And the interesting property here is that it makes the potential time independent. So you start with something time dependent. You use this clock, which is its own its own quantum uncertainty and how it beats, and your evolution becomes time independent. So it opens the question, can you use the beats of your quantum uncertainty or also the higher moments, the non-Gaussianities of your wave function at different degrees of freedom, internal degrees of freedom that you could use as clocks, that could be, that could have interesting properties to describe classical mechanics or field or apply to quantum gravity. So here, I've arrived at describing the quantum uncertainty of a single wave packet. I mean, that's not an incredible feat. Huh? So the next thing that I wanted to do was to try to understand what happens if I have quantum superposition, so two wave packets and they crash together. So quantum scattering. So usually when you look at two particle scattering, then I remember that you have the conservation of momenta, conservation of energy, and you can look at all the powers of P. But here, I was not interested in powers of P, I was interested in powers of X. And trying to understand, when you have a quantum scattering, what happens to the quantum uncertainty of your wave packets? So I scatter them. I don't only look at the entanglement between that results from the scattering, but from the quantum uncertainty of your two particles. So this is an open question. And to really answer it, then you have to add something non-trivial to your system. Huh? Because if you take two wave packets, they're just in usual Schrödinger without potential, it's just going to go through. They don't interact with each other. Huh? So it's the quantum superposition, it's linear. So nothing happens. Huh? So really, I want to have a real scattering, so something happening, a shock there. And to have that, you need to add a self-interaction term to the Schrödinger equation. So just like in quantum field theory, when you add a 5-4 or higher order term for the self-interaction, you need something like that to have a scattering event. And so here, I naturally have to work in a non-linear Schrödinger equation. So that's where the second story is going to start. And I'm going to underline a different reason to go to non-linear Schrödinger equation. So I don't know if the quantum or gravity came first at the Big Bang, but let's assume that gravity was there before quantum mechanics. And so I'm going to have quantum mechanics, and I'm going to see, to try to understand how gravity modifies it. Okay? So it's not going to be like real quantum mechanics or relativistic field theory. No, I'm just going to look at one-dimensional quantum mechanics. So the Schrödinger action for the wave function with the dt term and the Laplacian term. So it's a 1 plus 1 non-relativistic field theory. And what happens if I try to add g Newton to that? So which interaction terms can be coupled to that using Newton's constant? Okay. So I came back to something I'm really not used to, looking at different dimensions for my constants. I didn't put numbers, but just the dimensions. Okay. And then you need to understand what terms that you're going to add. So it turns out that you have only two possibilities. If you want only derivatives, so you want something which is homogeneous, but it's not like a potential depending on the position, and you want it to be polynomial in your wave function, because it would be awkward to have square roots of your wave function. So you only have two possibilities. You have a term with a single derivative and a psi 4 term. So let's write this action. So this is the usual Schrödinger, the free Schrödinger action. Then you have the first term, which is this term there, which is simply comes from translating, doing a Galilean boost. Okay, easy. The point is that this doesn't change much the theory because it's a quadratic term in the wave function. So the field equation, the equation of motions, are going to be linear. So it's not going to break the linear superposition of quantum mechanics. But this term is more interesting because it's in psi 4. It is more than quadratic. So it's going to give you a nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So the goal is to try to understand what happens in that case. So I know that nonlinear Schrödinger equations have been studied a lot. So Maybe you already know everything I'm going to say. I'm just going to try to draw lessons from what's already known. So to understand the structure of the theory, I'm just going to do its Hamiltonian analysis. So the field is conjugate to its complex conjugate, and you compute the Hamiltonian, which is the Laplacian term, plus the Psi-4 interaction term. So this is the free term. It is the Laplacian term, which is going to lead to the diffusion of wave packets. One must remember that if you have free Schrödinger equation, you don't have any stable wave packets. Wave packets spread, always. So it is very non-classical. It is quantum mechanics. So if usually you want to have something which is localized, something stable, some wave packets, then you need to add some extra force. So usually you add a potential well, a potential, something like that. But here you don't have any. So things are going to spread out. On the other side here, you have a synth interaction term. And this term is going to either favor to be some attractive force between the different, the wave function is going to attract itself or is going to repulse itself. So when depending on the sign of the coupling, it's going to create a clustering or to help diffusion. So here, I believe that gravity is going to be attractive. So in the case where B here is positive, then this nonlinear term is going to create some self-localization of your wave function. So instead of having a free diffusion, it's going to try to stabilize things. So the question here, is it enough to stabilize? Is it too much and it's going to collapse? So nonlinear Schrödinger is well done. So it stabilizes. And so Gaussian wave packets are going to be replaced by soliton solutions, which are like that. So instead of having some Gaussian drop, you're just going to have an exponential drop, but it's going to be localized wave function. So you can compute, you can determine all the different parameters of your wave function, of your soliton solution, and you can compute its width here. Here n is the normalization of your wave function, normally fixed to 1, but you can consider that your wave function carries many particles, and the width of your solution is going to scale with the number of particles. So yeah, in the lesson, the first lesson here is that in this toy model, the gravitational effects are going to counter the free diffusion of wave packets in quantum mechanics, and things are not going to collapse, but you're going to have stabilized, localized excitations, or wave packets. So if you want to understand this a bit more, beyond the soliton solution, then the most obvious way to do it would be to look at Gaussian wave packets. So can you generalize the approximation of Gaussian wave packets here and look at some effective dynamics of these Gaussian wave packets? So I do the thing that usually we are told not to do. I take an ansatz and I plug it into the action. But it works if there's not too much deviation. So it is a good approximation for small perturbations. And I've checked it. It works on the computer numerically. So if I do that, which is some kind of mini superspace model, we do that in quantum gravity, in gravity all the time. We take some metric, we plug it into the action, and we study that. So here we do it. So I am as happy as when I do mini superspaces. And I get an effective action there. The effective action, so as before, you have variables corresponding to your classical trajectory and variables constant about your quantum uncertainty, and you have some effective potential. Here you have the p squared term of classical mechanics. Here you have a term which is the free evolution of a quantum uncertainty. Here you have a conformal potential term which drives the diffusion of your wave packet. And here you have a new term which comes from your nonlinearity. Okay? And then I looked at that and I noticed that this is just what I teach students about Newtonian mechanics. So this is like the gravitational potential in 1 over alpha, in 1 over r. And this is the angular momentum term in 1 over r squared. So if I look at the dynamics of your quantum uncertainty, this is exactly as the gravitational two-body problem. So here, you've gravitized quantum mechanics, but if you look at the evolution of classical of Gaussian wave packets, then it is a gravitational analog of a two-body problem. So you started by putting gravity, but you get gravity not in real space, but in field space.
So sorry, alpha and beta are time derivatives of P and Q.
Sorry?
What are alpha and beta?
Alpha and beta? It's the parameters I had given earlier. Alpha is the position uncertainty, okay. And beta is the momentum uncertainty, the spread. But come back long time ago.
Define via your Gaussian packet.
Okay. Yeah, here.
Okay.
Clack, alpha and beta. Okay, but it's going to flash a bit. Sorry. Thromboscopes. Whoa, we're here. All right? Okay. Okay, so gravity is an analog for nonlinear quantum mechanics. So usually we try to find quantum analogs of gravity, but for once it's in the other way around. So also, because it is gravity, I know how to solve it. Okay? So you have parabolic, hyperbolic trajectories, and elliptic trajectories. But here, the radius of your, what plays the role of the radius is the spread in position. So you are happy, you have a bounded, a stabilized uncertainty when you have an elliptic trajectory, which you get when the energy is negative. So when beta is positive, when B is positive, when your coupling constant here is positive. So you're always going to have bounded position uncertainty. But here it's going to be a bit more general. In the case of a soliton, it was a fixed width, so it was constant. But here on an elliptic trajectory, the width is going to change, it's going to evolve, it's going to beat. So of course, I checked whether my approximation was fine or not. And yes, it's almost fine. It's almost like the solitonic solution. The little difference when you look at parameters and the width, it's some 0.9 and 0.88. I don't know if it's something significant or not, but it looked small enough for me. So basically, my Gaussian wave packet approximation is not too bad compared to a solitonic solution. So really here, the point is that before I had soliton with a fixed width, and now I wanted to have something that changed with time. But the quantum uncertainty evolves, is not fixed. And this is going to be given by elliptic trajectories for Gaussian wave packets. Because the width, the quantum uncertainty is going to fluctuate. It should approximate some kind of exact pulsating solitonic solution for nonlinear Schrödinger. I haven't found that in the literature, but maybe it has already been done in the exact thing. But really, it's the point I want to get here is that I wanted to move to nonlinear Schrödinger equation to push further the analysis I had done on using the quantum uncertainty as a clock. And I do arrive not exactly to which I wanted, but to the same point, is that if there exists solution to nonlinear Schrödinger that have a pulsating quantum uncertainty. So like the kind of, I like the picture of some kind of beating heart of your wave packet. So you have your classical trajectory, your system evolving on your classical trajectory, and its quantum uncertainty is just pulsates there. And you can use that as a clock. So here, I started by looking at gravitational effects on quantum mechanics. In order to model, and I showed that you can take them into account by looking at self-interaction of your wave function. But this leads to a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, and that this is actually approximated by gravity in field space. So it's funny to start with gravity in real space and get gravity in field space. So this is something that I would like to understand more. But since my talk was about quantum gravity, and here I haven't even talked about quantum gravity, I'd like to have a third chapter on quantizing gravity. Starting with a remark, is everything that I've talked about relevant for quantum gravity? So is there a way to see that my thoughts about nonlinear Schrödinger equations are relevant for quantum gravity? So of course, as I said earlier, nonlinear Schrödinger equation is the simplest nonlinear field theory. Okay, it is a one plus one dimensional, it is non-relativistic, it's not different invariant. But maybe you can use it as some basic toy models for GR, maybe to look at conserved charges or corner algebras. It has a very nice integrable structure. But can it be more than a very stupid toy model? So here it's going to be the return of GR. So let us look at mini superspaces. So spherically symmetric metrics in GR. So my goal, obviously, is to go to describe black holes. So I'm going to write the usual mini superspace such that its solutions are the Schwarzschild metrics, and that it's going to describe black hole geometry with horizons, which is really the proof of concept configuration for GR. I mean, it's the main object that you use to validate experimentally general relativity beside gravitational waves. So let's do a bit of GR, write equations and curvature. Okay. So I will start with the Einstein-Hilbert action. Here it's the Planck length factor in front, the curvature and the cosmological constant. I do what I said earlier was the ugly thing, but it's the usual thing that we do. That I take a metric, my ansatz of metric, and I plug it into my Einstein-Hilbert action. Here it's going to be fine because somehow I know that the solutions to my reduced action are going to be solution to my full action, which was not the case for nonlinear Schrödinger. So I take that with my two functions here and my n of r, which laps, but it's not n of t, so be aware of that. I parameterize everything in terms of two functions, alpha and beta, which are not the quantum uncertainty this time, alpha and beta of r. And here, my co-author really wanted to call this ratio c, a central charge. So everywhere you see c, it is not the speed of light. It is the difference, it is the ratio between the infrared regularization scale and the ultraviolet regularization scale given by the Planck length. So here there's a little parameter epsilon that you will see everywhere, which is just plus or minus. It's simply that it's minus when you are in the exterior region of your black hole and plus when you are in the interior of your black hole. So in this case, when epsilon is plus, actually r is a time. So that's why we decided to call it tau instead of r. So everywhere you see tau, it's not the time, but it's the radius r. But it's actually much more convenient because your action is now a function, an integral over tau. Because remember, this is a completely static metric. So there's no time evolution, but there's an evolution in the radial direction. So that's what I'd like to study. So my Einstein-Hilbert action evaluated on this metric is given by this, which is the integral of an evolution over my radial coordinate of this. So let's look at this action. So I remind you that alpha and beta are the components of my metrics. So they are the fields. Tau is this, so it's the radial component, renormalized by some fields. And that's the lapse in there. So it's like your proper time, your proper radius, your proper radial coordinate. So the lapse is hidden in there. This is a usual kinetic term for two fields. So it's like 2D mechanics. There's two degrees of freedom, alpha and beta. This depends on alpha, so it's a potential term. And this is a constant. So usually you don't put constant in your action. But since, remember, there's some lapse hidden in there, which means that the energy is going to have to be fixed to zero, a constant is important, and it creates an offset in your value of your Hamiltonian. So it's the energy offset. And so you can do the Lejeune transform and compute the Hamiltonian of your system, introducing momenta conjugate to alpha and beta, which I called this time normally P alpha and P beta. And you have the term in P squared, and you have a potential term in alpha. So when I want to study a classical system, I try to get all the constants of motions, meaning all the symmetries of your theory. Once I get all my constants of motion, it is obvious that we give the trajectory of your system. So to get the symmetries of constants of motion, how do I do that? So for the free theory, meaning that if you have only a kinetic term, then you see that your kinetic term is something in the square of your time derivatives. So it's really about a geodesic problem. So you can see that the symmetries are going to be given by the conformal Killing vectors on your field space. And then, since you have a potential, then it is the usual way is to see how your non-vanishing potential is going to break or affects those constants of motions. So actually, this little black hole mini superspace is part of a larger program I have with some of my collaborators of finding hidden symmetries of GR. So what do I mean by that? That there's actually plenty of hints that there's more symmetries in GR than simply the gauge symmetry and the diffeomorphisms. There's plenty of extra symmetries that you can find in reduced models, like integrable structures, like the Gerock group. There's the Janis-Newman algorithm to create angular momentum. There's been plenty of work on ladder symmetries, ladder operator symmetries for quasi-normal modes, so for Gaussian perturbations. There's plenty of people here working on edge modes and boundary symmetry algebras, which tend to reveal that there's something more than diffeomorphisms. So there seems to be some hidden symmetries there. So what we mean usually by hidden symmetries is that they are not revealed by simply looking at Killing vectors or conformal Killing vectors on the field space, but they are going to be given by something beyond. So you can consider Killing tensors, you can consider plenty of structures beyond Killing vectors that are going to reveal more observables which are explicitly time dependent and so on. There's plenty of work. That's the work that I've done on that with Djibril Benachour and Marc Geller, which are both in Lyon. So here there's plenty of work since a few years because we didn't really understand what we were trying to do. So we refined it and we're starting to get there. So if I apply this program to the system that I have here, it is 2D mechanics. It is strange that actually there can be many constants of motion. It can look more complicated than you think. So we arrived at the maximal symmetry algebra of the system, which is recognized simply as the Schrödinger algebra. It is called the Schrödinger algebra despite that it's classical mechanics, because it is the maximal, it is also the symmetry group of a quantized system. So it's the maximal algebra of the classical system, which is preserved under quantization, by canonical quantization. So the two here is for 2D, because you have 2 degrees of freedom. And so it is SL2R, direct sum with SO11, plus direct sum R2 plus R2. So what are all these things? So these are the translations, so simply generated by the momentum. So I gave you formulas here. They are not as simple as this is pretty ugly. And then the other R2 is the Galilean boosts. So how you do boosts, so non-zero velocities. And you see that these are explicitly time dependent. Huh? So you see some tau here. So it's time dependent conserved charges. So really these give you the evolution, since this is a constant, then you see that this is actually the, well, let's say this one because it's much simpler, formula. Then this is the initial condition for square root of alpha. Okay? So this contains the trajectories for alpha and beta. So it's in this way that time-dependent conserved charges, constant of motions, which are time-dependent or evolving conserved motion, contain explicitly the solution to your classical problem. Then you have some kind of SO11 boost. So this is that. This is the rotation in the alpha-beta plane. But it turns out that it's not really rotation because there's a little wrong sign, and so it's boosts. So actually, alpha-beta is a Lorentzian plane instead of an Euclidean plane. So for those who are used to the Schrödinger algebra, the epsilon here, which is a plus or minus, which signals the interior and exterior of a black hole, it is the central charge of your Schrödinger algebra. Here you have the conformal transformations, which basically give you the evolution of beta, whose derivative is this modified dilatation operator generator, whose time derivative, meaning the acceleration of beta, is simply the Hamiltonian. So you have this beautiful algebra. Everybody is happy. I give the missing part of it. Okay. So let's say that somebody did all that work and had the symmetry algebra. Your goal now is to quantize the system. And if you want to quantize the system, you have a choice. What do you do? Do you break the symmetry? Do you preserve it? Do you simply deform it? So usually, we want to preserve your symmetries as much as you can. When you deform or you break it, you're doing something pretty violent. And usually, each time you break a symmetry or you deform it, it has a very strong physical experimental signature. So let's try not to deform it, not to break it, and just preserve it. So I forgot this little remark, which is that maybe it is nice to keep track for physical purposes what is the mass, so your only non-trivial degree of freedom for black holes, in all that. It was given by a constant of motion, which is P, and which is J and P minus. So that was a translation generator, and that was a boost generator. So it is a constant of motion, but it is not something fixed. It's not a Casimir of your symmetry algebra, because I mean, I'm looking at the phase space of all black hole solutions, so the mass is not fixed. It is important to remember the mass is not fixed. Because when I quantize the system, I'm going to look at superposition of different black holes with different masses. Okay. So let's quantize. I look at the metric components, and I take a wave function of these. And then I can write free mechanics, which is just like that, which is just the Schrödinger equation on your field space, on your metric space. Okay. I'm just going to show you the Hamiltonian. Oh, I lost the Hamiltonian. So that's the Hamiltonian that I want to quantize. You see, it is polynomial. You can quantize it. You're not going to sweat. It's going to be rather easy. So I do that. I quantize it. And there's nothing special. Yeah. I can write the paper, and the referees are going to tell me, but so what? So the point is that maybe I don't just want to quantize. Actually, as I said at the beginning of my talk, quantum gravity is not necessarily going to be about simply quantizing GR. We always expect to have something more, some deformation of your quantization, some extra ingredients. And usually, these extra ingredients in all the approaches introduce some kind of discreteness. So in loop gravity, you have the area gap. You have a string tension in string theory, which is a parameter that controls the non-locality of your interactions. You have 1/n corrections in like holographic schemes using random tensors or random matrices. You have a sprinkling density in causal sets. Oh, there's always one other parameter, something that is said that is not simply H bar, but something else that controls the quantization of your theory. So here I'm going to do the same. I'm going to think, OK, let's add something to it. So I have Schrödinger action. What I've said during all my talk, I'm going to move to nonlinear Schrödinger. It's the simplest thing I can do. So the question is, can I add a self-interaction term to my black hole, my quantum black hole dynamics, while preserving the symmetry? I like it when you ask a question and there's a unique answer. So there's a unique potential self-interaction term which preserves all the symmetries, which is, ta-da, the one that I've been studying since the beginning, Psi 4. Okay. Very lucky, but yeah, it's the usual thing that is known in quantum hydrodynamics, in 2D quantum hydrodynamics, that the Psi 4 has a very nice conformal symmetries. So it's the only one that preserves the whole Schrödinger symmetry. So my point here is that if I want to quantize and possibly deform my system while preserving all its symmetries, there's a unique way to do that. So if quantum, if any of your quantum gravity scheme is supposed to preserve the symmetries of a black hole mini superspace, it would necessarily mean that it's going to predict something of that form. So from that point of view, it's some universal quantum gravity predictions for the evolution of black hole wave packets with this little kappa, which is, might depend on your approach. So if I do that, what is the phenomenology? What's going to happen? So yeah, I'm putting some self-interactions of the black hole wave functions. So here, myself, I'm always a bit skeptical of what I really mean by a superposition of a black hole. So imagine you have a black hole there, and you have the same black hole, but with a different mass. So I'm considering a wave packet of these two. I don't really know if I can do that physically, but it's what we say that we do. So let's assume that it has a physical meaning. And so now this parameter there is going to create some attraction. Well, I put kappa squared. So yeah, I'm going to get some, I think I've put some repulsion on my probability peaks. I'm not sure. But basically, you're going to get either some attractions between your two peaks of your wave function. So imagine you have a superposition of two masses. They are either going to attract each other or to repulse each other. If they attract each other, it means that they will like to collapse onto a single mass. They repulse each other. You're going to have like some kind of like different wave packets of your black holes are going to go away from each other. And so you're going to get in a very deep quantum regime some, with some very weird phenomenology. So in any case, this parameter is going to modulate the evolution of your metric superposition. I put evolution because it's not in time. It's in the radial coordinate, in the radial direction. So basically, it's going to modulate whether around the horizon of a singularity or at infinity, you are in the semi-classical regime or you are in a deep quantum regime. So it would be very interesting to understand better like this model, this phenomenology for quantum black holes as a 2D hydrodynamic system. So that's work that I've been doing with Jibril Benachour and Daniele Oriti. So we believe that it's going to be very interesting to look at the quantum to classical transition for black holes. And that it is also interesting that it gives a new type of writing analog models, analog condensed matter models for quantum gravity. Because here, it's not about some acoustic black holes of mimicking the metric of a black hole. It's really mimicking the metric infield space. So really looking at the dynamics of your metric itself. So what next? Because it's the end of the talk. So more work, because here, of course, I've told you about very, very basic stuff. But the direction in which I'd like to go, it's to study more between the really the interplay between the renormalization flow of gravity, which is supposed to be the main question of quantizing gravity, and the quantum to classical transition in quantum gravity, which is more about gravitizing the quantum. So when gravity makes quantum mechanics collapse or not. So to make this a bit more precise, I'm just joking. This is what I'd like to do. This is what my kids think I do. Okay? So I will wait for your questions now.
Thank you very much, Etera, for the talk. Questions? Yes. Thanks for this talk. So coming to your motivation, I understand why you introduced this Kappa term. So you want to have like something that preserves the symmetry of your system, and at the same time something that gives you a deformation. But can you give some more like motivation for why this is the kind of deformation you want to have? I mean, you were referring to the area gap, for example, in Newcomb gravity.
Oh no, I don't have any way to derive this from one of the quantum gravity approaches for the moment. I don't know how to derive that from LQG or from others, because usually people are going to focus on deforming the effective metric. So we think about we think in principle about superposition of black hole states when we talk about the black hole entropy, but when we really do phenomenology of black hole, we always look at a deformed metric. So we don't really look at like the evolution of the quantum uncertainty of a black hole, which is really the object that we thought that we should consider here.
So
here the only motivation I have is that it is the only way to preserve the symmetries, and symmetries are very important.
Okay, and so do you have any intuition about what it's like, what kind of deformation or what effects, like possibly observable effects, this could generate?
As I said, it's about like making a superposition of black holes collapse or not. So you'd like to have such a deformation so that it is at infinity, that it is more or less semi-classical, but it makes your black hole superposition collapse. You cannot have superposition of mass at infinity. Mm-hmm. Well, it's what I think is would be reasonable, that maybe when you go closer and you go within the black hole, you might get superpositions of different wave packets. But unsure. You need to think about it. But it's really something which is not about only gravity, but it's also, I think, quantum foundation. So you need to think about it.
Yeah.
Bianca?
Yeah, first, I had some technical thing. In your last Schrödinger action, you had dt, and then you had dt again two times, which seemed to be a bit weird. Is that correct?
Dt?
The second term also has a
beta. Oh yeah, this is bad. This is really ugly. Yeah, it was some d alpha and d beta.
But
yeah, sorry.
Different.
It's the Laplacian. I think I copy paste.
Okay, so it's not.
Yeah. Laplacian in alpha and beta.
And a different version. So it's also for the first part. That's very nice. That basically quantum mechanics provides, in some sense, a constant frequency.
Ah, yeah.
It reminds me of some work of Martin Boyle, which by the way also is all the momenta.
Yeah, that's I learned about the effective approach to quantum mechanics from Martin.
Yes, also some work where he uses oscillations of atoms and so on as a clock. There's always a question whether you can really count.
Mm-hmm.
This phase space, but he has some works also related to that, so maybe there's some relation.
Okay, I'll check. He has many papers.
Yeah. But I can point you towards. So.
Okay. Yeah, Lee.
Well, I understood about half of that, which was more than I expected to. So what I don't understand, the half that I don't understand, is that when you're talking about gravitational wave packets or wave packets in the state space of black holes, you're talking in a language of reduced objects and particles. And that's not the quantum field theory language. that we're speaking and when we're doing what we call climate gravity. I'm not saying when it's wrong and when it's right, but do I understand correctly that you're in some kind of strange new band?
Yeah.
You're halfway between climate change and climate change.
Yeah, exactly, totally. Yeah.
Why don't you run from that? Why?
I mean, the goal, here it's really the spherically symmetric. So yeah, it's not entirely, I am not satisfied with quantizing spherically symmetric objects. Because of course, for everything, for every process, I think it's going to be local. So Hawking evaporation is not just the black hole look something spherically symmetric. It's something that's going to be local at different places. This was just some kind of first step. Yeah, we really want to put to add the perturbation at least around the horizon. So to look at gravitational perturbation with arbitrary angular momentum. Basically, but in the logic of quasi-normal modes, and to see if there's a similar way to deform. I mean, look at the symmetries of all gravitational quasi-normal modes, and look if there's a way to properly quantize that, preserving the symmetries.
Do you know the result that was found years ago for quasi-normal modes of black holes? That when it takes the first n modes of a celestial black hole and adds up their frequency, that comes out to what it would be if you quantize the object.
Okay. I'll take this.
I'm trying to remember the first thing.
Okay.
Jim, North Carolina.
Okay, I'll try to find that.
The great class of relativists who works in North Carolina.
Okay, thanks for pointing this out. I will check it out. Yeah?
Could you comment a bit more about what you mean by normalization group flow? Would you like to compute the flow of kappa, for example, or coupling constant? And in particular, would you think of including more operators, which would then change your black hole solutions? And so what would you do if you have more than one horizon where your radial coordinate changes?
Now, there, at the end, when I talk about the normalization flow of GR, I was just dreaming, really trying to understand what, like, if I really had the normalization flow of GR, you know, even if you do it perturbatively, the loop corrections, which is supposed to be about the running of your constant with a length scale. What does it have to do with the quantum to classical transition of Gottschall state, which is supposed to be the coarse graining of quantum gravity states when you change the size, the length scale? So the two things is about some behavior of your quantum fluctuation of gravity on the length scale. So are they supposed to be the same thing or not? And I'd like to understand that.
But do you think there is a way to somehow go a bit higher in the order of curvature and then see if there is a deformation parameter from black hole solution one to the next one and somehow incorporate the flow of these couplings in these deformation parameters?
That'd be great. Yeah. It could work, yeah. I haven't tried, but yeah.
Other questions?
So, why did you mention this discreteness observation? Because because it's cool, it didn't really play a role afterwards, right? Like,
oh no, it's just say that. I was thoughtful. I was thinking of like all the different ingredients that we add to quantum gravity, like the extra parameter that you add. It's always, I don't know if it's some lack of imagination or that it's some deeper truth about quantum gravity.
Right, but this extra, like this self-interaction didn't introduce any discreteness.
No, it's simply based on the remark that we are not going to simply quantize GR. I mean, if we do that, then we know that it gives a non-randomizable quantum field theory. So we add something else. In that case, so it's really that you deform the way you quantize the theory. So here it's the same. Like, I'm not going to say that it's simply quantize, just raise to quantum operators and have a wave function. I'm going to put some extra ingredients, some nonlinearity of in the evolution of your wave function of a black hole.
Yeah.
you hope that this is some effective description of
I start with
state dynamics
the usual remark the usual logic that I want symmetry to be preserved. There's only a unique way to do that. And if there's something that's possible, it should be realized. So, yeah, that's the only way to do it. So if any of the quantum gravity approach don't do that, it means that they will break the symmetries of classical mechanics. And so something big will happen, different, not sure what. Yes, Lee?
On any one of your breaking of symmetries, which is really not effective. So you break the linearity in the Hilbert space.
Yes. Yeah.
So why aren't we calling that all the ways not to quantize gravity?
Yeah, maybe there's some totally different way. Here I was just going to the simplest way of doing was deforming the canonical quantization procedure, but. Very likely, for full GR, for full quantum gravity, you're supposed to do something much wilder. Yeah. But here, also the fact that it's a 5-4, there's a lot of phenomenology done. There's plenty of people that do 2D hydrodynamic system. So there's things. It's not my work. So, but if you want, if people are interested, we can talk about like experimental prospects for that. But
Just to clarify, you want to treat the psi as the order parameter, right? For the quantum to classical transition that you were referencing.
Yes.
Yeah, so then this action looks like the Ginsburg-Landau action for Ising model, right? So you can just stare at the phase diagram that people have done in the 70s to look at the phase transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So what does that mean for gravity?
I don't know yet. We are looking. We are exactly there, staring at the phase diagram. And
You want to make that mistake creatively. That is, you want to make the mistake that makes quantum mechanics and quantum gravity non-linear. And you want to not turn away from that, but keep going and find some other structure that then all of those non-linearities fit into. Is that fair?
Yes. I'd like to, that's the way, that's the path I'm taking,
Okay, let's thank Ether again.